It's always a dangerous thing to follow David Blunkett because he's so eloquent, so convincing. If I might begin by actually an anecdote involving David, which is about politics. When I was working in the Times, it goes back to 1999, I wrote something about schools. David was then education secretary. He said, right, come up to Sheffield for a day, which I did. And it was absolutely classic illustration. He mentioned the estates in Brightside. There are some very depressing places there. Abandoned cars, looted places. I went to a lunch at one of the comprehensive schools there, where one of the head teachers said, the free school meals is a completely misleading indicator of poverty. We just look across at the chippies, that's where they go at lunchtime, they claim school meals. It was actually a very interesting illustration of the power of politics. Going to a Sure Start scheme, which was just starting then. A lovely lady had a brilliant idea to improve diet. It was on the Pennine Way, so what you do is get allotments. It improves the diet immensely. I mean, just things like that shows the power of politics. But there's one particular illustration that day. It was in the City Hall. David had an open meeting with some teachers, and some pupils came along, and they was all to discuss what was happening in schools. And there was one tubby lad got up. He looked like a young Roy Hattersley, and since the Hattersleys come from Sheffield, it could have been a distant cousin. And in a broad... I wouldn't want to get into that territory. Anyway, in a very broad Yorkshire accent, he got up and said, don't mind about the numeracy hour, but not too keen on the literacy hour. It goes on a long time. To which David said afterwards, who let that little be in? But it was a wonderful illustration of the perils of interaction. Also, I'm delighted to be here in the 50th anniversary of the publication of Bernard Crick's great book. I had some dealings with Bernard Crick because I also chair the Hansard Society, which promotes understanding of Parliament. I'm stepping down after 5 years as chair this summer. And shortly before Bernard died, I was up in Edinburgh doing something, in fact, with Charlie Jeffrey. And Bernard came up to me and we were talking about Hansard. He said, you know why Stephen King all founded it? I said, no. He said, well, he explained to me that the reason he wanted to keep the spirit of democracy alive was to ensure that the spirit and the ethos of the national government of the 1930s would be preserved. Now, I've got a member of the council of the Hansard Society sitting, Ivor Gabriel, in front of me. That's not quite how we view things now, but it shows how politics can have a long-lasting influence in the most obscure ways. It's also very good to be here, and I'd like to thank Paul and his colleagues for their generosity and hospitality, because if anywhere demonstrates the need, not only for politics, but politicians, it's Northern Ireland. And I think it's quite interesting that some of the most engaged political academics are actually the ones in Northern Ireland, because they damn well got to be. If you lived through the last 40, 50 years, you're living through something where politics matters. And it reflects in some of the panels we've got here. Interesting point that David mentioned was the re-election of George Galloway. Now someone who's been elected to three different seats, excluding the more exotic one mentioned by David. What was interesting on what happened on Thursday was the three main parties only got 38% of the vote. So in part, what we're talking about, and this is the ambiguity when one talks about in defence of politics and politicians, are we talking about in defence of parties? Because it underlying the debate on the role of politicians and politics is that of parties. Because George Galloway has played it brilliantly, as you'd expect for such a... a graduate of Big Brother House, with typical panache, and he's claimed it's an example of disillusion with politicians. Well, he, of course, is one of the most skillful politicians imaginable himself. So we have to look at the face there. I read a book last year, and I've been involved in very much in parallel with Matt Flinders in this debate in defence of politics for politicians. I did a lecture 2 years ago for Parliamentary Affairs and Hansard Society just before Matt's inaugural lecture at Sheffield that May. Not a happily timed one because it was on election day. And he's produced his book. I produced my book in defence of politicians in spite of themselves. The core thesis there is really, if you believe in representative democracy, a vibrant political debate, you've got to have politicians. There's no way you can get away from it. And I think a lot of people are guilty of not appreciating that clearly. My old trade, which I occupied for 40 years as a political journalist, not least in that. Why do we get it wrong? And also, David mentioned some various other challenges to politicians as well, which I'd agree with some of. I think the key point is we expect too much. We define it in absolute terms. But the essence of politics, the essence of what a politician does, they're often, if you look up references, Tony Wright's done this in his delightful memoir and a series of essays, that the ways politicians are described, dissemblers, deceivers, you just have to look at any dictionary of quotation, look how it's described by Shakespeare, look at the national anthem, which is very rude about scurvy politicians, because they're assumed not to be honest. But that's assuming and putting a standard, which to my mind is misleading. It assumes an absolutism. It assumes that if you say something to the electorate, you must, by definition, always carry that through. The problem is what you're saying. And why I'm, for example, critical of the Lib Dems before the election is the Lib Dems before the election had the whole raison d'etre of the Lib Dems before the election was if they succeeded, they'd be entering into coalition, and that would involve bargaining, compromise. They believed in the politics of cooperation, not the politics of absolute majoritarianism. That's the essence of the Lib Dems, because they also believe in electoral reform. But that didn't tally with what they actually said in their policy proposals. They said their policy proposals in the most absolute imaginable terms, not as a bargaining counter, but as something which they would do. And in a sense, curiously, the Lib Dems were an anti-political party in what they did. They had brilliant tactics in negotiation, and they were better prepared than any of the other parties, possibly, curiously, apart from Oliver Letwin, who I think was probably the best prepared of all. But apart from Oliver, they were the best prepared. However, they were not prepared in policy terms, because they set out a platform, and they paid dearly for having to compromise, particularly on tuition fees, but on some other areas. But the essence of coalition is, of course, compromise. Nothing infuriates me more than when I heard a Tory MP complain about we are not able to do our policies. No, I'm afraid you're not able to do your policies. You didn't win the last election, you didn't get a majority on it. Therefore, you've got to compromise. And I think that curiously, the political dialogue in Britain hasn't yet adjusted to being a properly political dialogue. Because we have a majoritarian system, or have had, in general, a majoritarian system, we're used to absolutes. A party which has a majority can do what it wants to do. We're not used to a situation of true politics where you bargain, where politicians represent interests and reconcile them, and there is nothing wrong with compromise there. I think the political classes haven't really fully adjusted to that. They're still really hoping that there'll be a single party majority after the election. There is a sense of this is a period of aberration. This is a slightly freaky period, wonderful for all of us who commentate, analyse and all that, wonderful material, but this will go in May 2015. They may well be right or wrong, and there'll be plenty of discussion about that over the next 3 days. But I think that the media certainly are trapped in a view of regarding this as a temporary period before we move on to, or move back to, a period of single-party government. So I think that one of the most fascinating things is the existence of the coalition as a challenge to our view of politics and politicians. Actually, the people who dropped the coalition agreement in May 2010 were acting as politicians. They were responding to what the cards the electorate had given them, that no party had a majority, and they were compromising. That's exactly what it should be about. And I regard nothing wrong in that. However, to defend politicians in that way runs against the grain, where the word betrayal comes up immediately. I mean, David used it, I think probably, the word betrayal was used in May 1997, almost within a day of him becoming a minister. People want to cry betrayal all the time. That is a fundamental misreading, to my mind, of what politics involves. Let me just very briefly go through, and finally, before handing over to Matt, some challenges. The all crooks one, well, Matt and I have demolished that. If you look at the expenses scandal, appalling. What was really bad about it wasn't the number of people who were, so to speak, crooks, some of whom have ended up in prison, others have been disgraced and forced out of public life, but the moral ambiguities of the position, the fact that politicians didn't feel they could defend a proper expenses system. Plenty of people have been in that position. That was the really thing which was wrong about it, not the number who were outright sinners, but it was a minority of that. All in it for themselves. Salary levels appear generous by the standards of average pay, but they certainly, with the tightening up of the expenses regime, certainly not for the range of talent in both the public sector and private sector professions, where most politicians are drawn from. Out of touch. I regard that as one of the most absurd arguments against politicians. They're more in touch than they've ever been, because they have to be. I remember when I was first a political journalist over 30 years ago, listening to, I wandered in, there were then regional debates. There was a debate on Yorkshire and Humberside. And Major Patrick Wall, a redoubtable Tory squire, was talking about his annual visit round his constituency. Even then, there were kind of slight titters. Annual visit round, what he meant was going around the villages in September, because it was a very big rural seat. But that wasn't so far true. And there were plenty of Labour members who went practically nowhere near their constituencies, because they were looked after by the local councillors. That was destroyed by a combination of re-selection of the Labour Party and the rise of the Liberals in the SDP Liberal Alliance. It'd be impossible now to do that. I remember talking to Paul Tyler, who has an interesting record of having 18 years between his two periods as MP. And I said to him, what really changed between your two periods as MP? And he said, oh, the volume of correspondence. It rose sixfold. And there's a massive amount of correspondence. The internet facilitates that and all that. That they're not out of touch. I think one of the problems is that many MPs are too much in touch and don't play a big enough role at Westminster. Now, finally, academia. I've in my book, I've said made some criticisms. I've made it in various other contexts of some of the academic discourse on politics and politicians. I think that there is a really big potential, as I say, in Northern Ireland, and a number of faces around this room, which I recognise, who do play a part in trying to bridge with the worlds of public policy. I'm very involved now as Director of the Institute for Government, a policy institute. We're more than a think tank. We seek to change policy. We're very involved with civil service and with ministers in that respect, and we've fortunately got the financial security to do that. But what I'm aware of is how distant often the political academic world is from the world of policymakers. They're really far apart in many areas. The economists aren't, because their services are called on. Various other parts of academia. It's very interesting. What group of academics is most influenced on this government? It's actually social psychologists. They've had more influence with Nudge and the behavioural theory. My old colleague from the IFG, David Halpin, who now runs the social behaviour unit, he definitely has more influence than I'd freely say anyone in this room. There's something wrong there. Why is it wrong? Two reasons. I think sometimes the way you talk and write, the trap, the pernicious trap, I might say, of American academia, the belief that if you get references in American academic journals, it's a good thing. Maybe, maybe not. But in politics of all disciplines, it should be written in terms which are intelligible to the people you're actually writing about, which is ordinary citizens. And I think too often, I see a lot of academic journals, it's written in an inward language of jargon. I mean, I wish editors of academic journals would just go through just striking out jargon. I'm very used to the next journalist, and I'm used now at the Institute for Government, where I have a lot of people who've got masters in political science, public administration, and so on, of trying to turn some of what they write into English. And sometimes it isn't. And you all know that. You all know that, but you're trapped. I remember reviewing for the TLS a book by a very bright young political scientist, and I said, it was a really interesting book. And I said, the trouble is, it was trapped by footnoteitis and jargon. And he sent me an email and said, but I'm trying to get on in political science. And it was a rather sad email. He said, thank you for the review, because it's basically favourable, but he felt he had to get on to become a reader and professor. The second thing is an over-reliance on mathematics. I've been a couple of events in the last 3 months where I've had very distinguished academics build things on survey evidence, which the practitioners could readily tell you was absolute codswallop. Because the assumptions behind the surveys were fallacious. There's a belief that if you have a mathematical model, it's going to be right. I'm afraid quite often it's wrong, because if you know what the weakness of the survey evidence is, you wouldn't be doing it. I plead for a little more relationship with the ordinary world. We at the IFG are trying to provide links. We work very closely with the PSA. We're hosting 3 briefings at present ahead of the elections, as we did last year, which were very successful. We want to do more with the PSA. But if you're going to be involved with the policymakers, you've got to move too in the way you talk and some of the things you do. And I think because that actually makes it harder to understand politics and to understand politicians. Politicians and civil servants won't listen to you unless you alter some of the language in which you talk in yourselves. Thank you. Thank you.